No one wants to be Sandy. Welcome to Groovy Movies. My name is Lily Austin.
And my name's James Brailsford. Hello.
Hi, James. How are you?
I am not too bad, thanks. I've had a nice weekend with my friends, you know, being all social and also nice. Pondering the theme of today's episode. How have you been?
Oh, yeah. Also doing a lot of pondering, because this week we are talking about main characters versus side characters, specifically when main characters emit more of that side character energy and it's the side characters that are the more interesting ones.
Absolutely. And these have been three good films that are our like main films to discuss, because one that we haven't watched, but I think sums up this theme of this idea of the central character might be a little bit empty, but there's colourful side characters that orbit around them. The one that immediately comes to my mind is like Star Wars.
Yeah.
Luke Skywalker is a very low-key character. He's a very like every guy type, and it makes all these other characters pop and come to life. Did make me wonder about, do you want to get into why we do seem to have this in films, or shall we pick that up on the way?
No, I think we should just dive right in.
Go in.
Go for it. Tell me what you think. Okay. What springs to mind?
Well, and I'd like to discuss this, especially with reference to Grease, our first film. But I think Star Wars and Grease, they have a lead character. We've got a male lead character in Star Wars, female in Grease. And my feeling is it so that the audience or some of the audience can insert themselves into that character? As a young boy, I definitely find Luke Skywalker way more relatable and the kind of character that I would like to think I would be, you know, but I couldn't imagine being Han Solo because he's way too cool. And watching Grease, I got the same feeling. The audience member wants to be Sandy, although I wouldn't know why you'd want to be Sandy. So,
no, anyway. I think you're right. I don't know if Sandy is a good example, actually. I'm not going to lie, but I think that is often. And that's like page one.
This is Lily's screenwriting 101, and rule one is.
And I really am but far from even half an expert on screenwriting. But here's my theory. So you can either go for having a really dynamic, active lead, like a James Bond type. And then there's the slightly more every man, like you said, person who, that's the idea that there are these bigger people around a more centered core, you know?
A very calm core. And then all this cast of eccentric characters of various degrees orbit around them. And if you had a central character who was just as colourful, I don't think you would be able to relate to any of it then. You need at least one character, I think, who the audience can in some way buy into.
Yeah.
I was just going to move us on to getting more into Grease, you know. I've not watched it from beginning to end, I don't think, since I was about 12, 13-ish. And I've seen clips of it throughout my adult life because it's one of those films that just, it's always managed to stay in the pop culture. So it was a very fun experience revisiting it because I thought I kind of knew it. I have to say as well, it looks incredible on the streaming version I got of it. It's obviously had a brand new transfer from the film element, so it just looks really good. I didn't appreciate rewatching it how cinematically directed it is. There's a lot of depth in the frames. There's lots of things going off. The shots are well designed. So I had a blast rewatching Grease. But what surprised me, though, I didn't remember at all that Sandy is played as an Australian who's come to Rydell.
I think it was her first film role, so it would have been a bit of an ask to also get her to do an American accent on top of that.
I did wonder, did they write it for her? Or did they rewrite it? And it's based on a musical that obviously it was all set in Chicago. So this was one of the things that they adapted when they made it to the feature film.
Yeah, so it was based on a 71 musical by Jim Jacobs and Warren Casey, directed by Randall Kleiser.
This is the feature film was directed by Randall Kleiser.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, good old Randall. So you've already kind of alluded to this. So you're thinking that Danny and Sandy are Luke Skywalkers of Grease.
You know, a little bit, yeah, a little bit. That's pretty much my thought. I think it's more that one half of our lead is the self-insert character. Although I suppose Danny is the aspiration.
But
if you're
young.
Who
would want to be Sandy?
I don't know. When you were watching it, when you were younger, what were your feelings towards Sandy?
That she was a wet blanket, for sure. No one wants to be Sandy. Everyone wants to be Sandy in the final scene of the movie. everyone wants to be sexy Sandy too. You know, all the girls want to be her, all the guys want to be with her.
She really does nail the sexy Sandy bit at the end, because she's played such a wet blanket for all the film that it does make that transformation. And I have to say, it kind of does earn that transformation.
I mean, when we asked our followers about their favourite, I think one of the first response was Rizzo from Grease. I think it's everyone's go-to example of an incredible side character. She is not like any other side character, I think, in any film, but specifically also in a high school movie. You don't really see people who really don't give any fucks whatsoever. And she really, really doesn't. And even has a banging song about it. She's so amazingly cynical. It's just the complete antithesis of Sandy, which I guess is her role, right?
Absolutely. And Stockard Channing just blew me away with her performance. I wonder if you are an actor, even though your ego might want to have the starring role to be the marquee name, I just think as an actor, if you enjoy acting and having interesting things to do, like Rizzo's character, she gets the most interesting things to do in the whole film. And also, I was amazed that she's got this cynical, acerbic sense of humour, but she's also got depth. And there's a few bits that kind of get you when she has the unexpected pregnancy and the way she handles that, and she's dealing with Kaneki. And I'd forgotten about Kaneki. Yeah. I'd forgotten that there's an apparently cooler version of Danny. He's the leader of the gang. I'd forgotten about him completely.
No. Danny, I'm sorry, hard disagree. Danny is the coolest. Kaneki is his sidekick. There are no two ways about it.
Okay. are you saying the sidekicks have sidekicks?
Of course. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a gang vibe. Yeah. Because also I would say that Danny, I mean, I really want to talk more about Sandy versus the other pink ladies. I think that's a bit more interesting. But definitely Danny is a bit more of a low-key character, which is what makes him so cool, right? Is that he just rolls with things.
He doesn't have the sense of humor, I don't think, that Danny has. He doesn't have the cheeky kind of quips as much. He's a much straighter character, I think, Kaneki. And I also think that out of all the gang members, Danny is played in a way that you can actually see him being a suitable romantic partner to the rest, because the others are either too immature. Well, they're all basically a bit too immature, but Danny is given just a little bit of wits and smarts, even though he's played occasionally as a buffoon, but not too much of a buffoon. So at the end, when Sandy becomes sexy Sandy, he kind of... it makes the match work between them. Yeah, it's very, very cleverly done.
Can I share my theory about why Sandy is such a boring character? Or, I mean, boring might be a bit harsh, but she is so good. She is like pure goodness and innocence, right?
But that's her entire character. There's nothing more to it.
Right. I was talking to my sister about this last night, and we were discussing how this is a movie all about sex, right? This is what the musical is about. It's about sex and sexual politics. So my sister was saying, because she's very into musicals, that you can tell what a musical is about by what they sing about, because the songs are the emotional arc of the film. They're the high point. So that's where you get all you need to know. So this is a film all about Sandy finding her sexual liberation and freedom to express herself. And there is a lot that's problematic with that. And I think it's not a coincidence that this is a film set in the 50s. We're on the cusp of a sexual revolution.
Yeah, but not quite.
What's going on with these teenagers is what America is heading towards, right? So this is like a little microcosm of the whole of society. And what's going to happen to their teenagers? But the point of Rizzo is that she is everything Sandy wants to be in her core. Even to the fact that Rizzo used to date Danny. That's like so important that slipped in there at the beginning. She's already been there and done that. So Rizzo's role is to be that aspirational character.
So she's Sandy's aspirational character. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it is interesting that you're right. There is this pregnancy arc for Rizzo where we think where we're headed, because she is slut-shamed at points during the film, that we think she's about to be paid her punishment for being sexually liberated because she thinks she's pregnant. But then at the end, we get the resolve of, no, I'm not pregnant. It's all good. I can carry on doing my wild things with no consequence. And it's great.
Thank goodness.
Now, I do think it's interesting that it is as much about sexual politics as it is about sex itself, because obviously for the men, this does reflect what happens in the 60s and what the critique of the free love concept is, that actually it was all about giving men free love and men the freedom to do what they want. And women were sort of hoodwinked into saying, oh yeah, this is what you want to be free and have sex with me.
Right.
When actually it would often come down to pressure. And I think there is something of that in this, because ultimately, where does this film go? She just suddenly decides one day that she's going to put on tight leather trousers, having up until that been resistant to any of it. It's not like she seemed to be into it. But Rizzo, she is such a good character, because despite all of that, she's so well played. There is this complexity to her, because she has this vulnerability that you see with her amazing song that she doesn't like to show, and she likes to protect herself because she has been shamed, essentially. It is definitely alluded to, for being a sexually free woman. So
yeah, and
that's kind of all what it comes down to. The thing that I found most shocking, that this was a PG, like some of the things they say, some of the lyrics, I had it with the subtitle song, there's quite a lot of mumbling in it. And I was like, oh my God, it's even more X-rated than I was thinking. But it was very fun to watch. I'm glad we found a reason to watch it.
I had a blast. I mean, again, one of the many reasons of doing this podcast with your good self is just that, just seeing films either that, you know, I probably wouldn't have got round to rewatching Grease anytime soon under my own steam.
Ordinarily, it would be a tough sell to have such a, to be honest, a bland protagonist, you know, someone whose only personality trait is goodness. But I think it is a testament to the film and everything around it that she's basically propelled along by the rest of the Pink Ladies and everyone else. Because it's not just Rizzo, even though she is obviously my favourite, I think most people's. But Frenchie is incredible too. She has real depth. Her going on her professional character arc is incredible. And Marty Maraschino, I mean, I'm obsessed with her. The charisma and the chemistry of the gangs in the film
make up for the quite bland central female leader. There's all this colour orbiting around her that allows that to happen. And I suppose ultimately it does really help the transformation when she becomes sexy Sandy at the end, because we have had 2 hours of her being just very passive character.
And there's something so pleasing about her fitting nicely into the Pink Ladies, finally, after all those hideous poodle skirts, you know? But it is interesting, right? It does show that good casting is so important, because if that gang hadn't been written as well as they were and didn't have as much chemistry as they did, this film would just be nothing.
No, absolutely. You can tell that they all had screen tests, and they must have all had what they call chemistry tests, where they will put different combinations of actors together, because you may individually screen test them and they're great, but sometimes you get them together and the sparks aren't there. But the sparks are flying between all the characters here.
Well, also, they did a few weeks of choreography and dress rehearsals beforehand, and the director really encouraged them to improvise and come up with ideas for each scene together. So really encourage that feeling of them all being friends.
Which it does.
And they genuinely were by the time they got to filming.
So like our film chat seemed to have occasional loose, unexpected connections. Until we started watching it, I was like, oh God, of course, we've got John Travolta decades later in this career rehabilitating film, because he'd been in the doldrums for quite some time. I mean, I remember watching Pulp Fiction, and it was a big deal that John Travolta was cast in it, because he's seen as a bit of a has-been, his heyday gone, you know. I can remember it clearly. This was the career turnaround for him. He'd spent, I would say, about 5 or 6 years in the doldrums. He was doing these Look Who's Talking films. So this is Quentin Tarantino doing what he does occasionally, which is get an actor who is good but has just lost their way a little bit, and he brings them back on the map.
I love that. It's a good move. Yeah. So in case you haven't seen it, John Travolta plays Vincent Vega. And Samuel L. Jackson plays his pal, Jules Winfield. And they are two hitmen?
Yeah, two
gangsters.
Gangsters, mobsters going around doing their mob bosses' bidding, basically.
So we follow them. Well, it's part of a kind of non-linear structured film.
Love that stuff.
Where you follow Yeah, I was going to say, I bet you love this. Where we have four slightly intertwining stories of crime and violence in LA. But in this particular story, the two of them are going to retrieve a briefcase from a business partner of their boss, and then violence and horrible things ensue.
I was watching this, I was just thinking, is this a film that doesn't really have one protagonist?
Well, that's what I was thinking initially. What do you think?
I think it is a film that doesn't really have protagonists, or they're all protagonists, basically, but they're all also side characters. Because what I love that emphasizes that is that as the film progresses, they'll pop up in each other's stories. So they do intertwine with each other. So a character you've met in one person's story pops up in another. So it gives you that feeling that these characters you are following are both. They're side characters, but they're also main characters. I think some characters are certainly more foregrounded. So John Travolta, Samuel L. Jackson, I think they have the most screen time in the film. But then you have people like Bruce Willis, who I think his story is possibly the least interesting story. But he, at the time, was at the height of his powers. This was classic era Bruce. So he was in a smaller part in this film. So he had what I would say is lead character energy just from he was Bruce Willis at the height of his powers, but he's playing a side character. I think this film plays with that idea of what makes a lead character, what makes a side character, and kind of messes around with them, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. When I think about it again, because that was my initial thinking when we were deciding on what to watch, and I thought Pulp Fiction is an interesting one because there isn't really a protagonist, that's lots of different stories, and how does that manifest? But then when I watched it, I thought John Travolta's character is central. In fairness, I don't know if that's partly because that scene with him and Uma Thurman dancing together has become such a iconic pop cultural touchstone that perhaps because of that, more than anything, I had a feeling of watching it because I was most familiar with that scene. I'd kind of forgotten a lot of everything else that had happened. So it might actually be more that than the film itself. But I think theirs is the only kind of sexy... Well, no, that's not true, actually, is it? Because Bruce Willis has a love story. But I don't know, the tension between him and Uma Thurman, I feel like, is an interesting anchor, which is like a nice breath from all the other stuff because there's so much violence and crime stuff, lots of guns throughout the film, and it's like a nice little break from that. So I think perhaps because of that, Vincent does feel like the protagonist to me. But it's interesting because he feels to me so much more passive than Samuel L. Jackson's character. Like, to me, Samuel L. Jackson is way more interesting.
I was just about to say a similar thing, which is that if you're going to look at the arc that a character goes on, then it's Samuel L. Jackson who's like, because he ends up questioning his life and wanting to leave behind his life of crime the same day that he's earlier massacred a room full of people. Whereas John Travolta, I think he doesn't really change as a character, let's say.
I would just like to
bring the spoiler card out here, because there's a few things I wouldn't mind discussing about the film. Am I allowed to play the spoiler card, or would you prefer me to?
No, let's go for it. I mean, it was made in 1994, and like, who hasn't heard of Pulp Fiction? Guys, if you don't want spoilers, just skip ahead.
This is what I love with the non-linear storytelling, that a main character is killed, which is John Travolta, and then he's resurrected because the story is being told out of sequence. So it's not undermining the character's death. It's not doing like a half fooled you, he's alive really. Just by the fact that the story is told out of order, you can resurrect that character. And I loved that. But one thing that I only realized by watching it this time around, I'm sorry if this is like crushingly obvious to everyone who's seen it, but I'd never realized that Vince Vega is somebody who is really on the ball until he goes to the toilet and he completely zones out. So when there's the robbery at the end where he's with Jules and he's in the diner, he goes to the bathroom and he sits out the majority of the holdup. And so you just think, that was lucky. That was pure luck that he happened to go to the toilet at that time. And also that he didn't just walk out and surprise them and get shot. And then, of course, that's how he dies halfway through the film. He's just on the toilet reading a magazine again. He just zones out.
Wait, but that's also what happens when Uma Thurman ODs on coke.
Oh, shit.
He's in the toilet reading. So his dominant characteristic is actually his passivity, because he's just there on the toilet reading a book, zoning out of everything. That was my point when I was watching the movie and seeing their dynamic. Is that it's Samuel Jackson who does everything. He is the active participant in their dynamic and in everything they do together, because he's the one who like talks to the people when they're picking up the briefcase and is in charge of the shooting. Like, John Travolta doesn't really do anything. He just like checks the briefcase. And it's then when John Travolta F's up and I'm going to say F's up after I've already said fuck, but after he kills the guy, it's Samuel Jackson who actually gets it sorted out. You know, it's his friend who helps him out, and he makes the phone call to bring someone in to sort everything out. And then at the end, the most interesting, I think, scene, the final scene, it's Samuel Jackson who does this really interesting turn of being totally in control when he is being victimized as a victim in a holdup at a diner. But he flips it all around. And as the audience, we're watching, you're not quite sure what's going to happen. And then are completely blindsided by how he deals with the situation.
Yeah,
and you're right, there is this very interesting character arc and development that John Travolta's character just doesn't get. It's so interesting because I was left thinking, it's a great movie, I wouldn't actually change anything. But I would have loved to have had a bit more... But that's probably a good thing, right? To be left wanting more from a character, being interested by them, I suppose.
Maybe there's a case that they're kind of the co-protagonist, John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson, that between them we get a hybrid, but he's very passive, John Travolta. The only time he seems to pipe up is when he feels like people aren't being polite or something, and it's just like, then he's just getting in the way, and he's just like, shut up. But
but you know what, I'm framing it in like a critical way, but that's the whole point, right? That's what's interesting, is that in that dynamic, and it's interesting in his story that he is the passive guy missing out on everything and ending up in these scrapes because he's gone to toilet. That is fun to watch, and as interesting as watching Samuel Jackson be much more witty and calculating and thoughtful in what he does.
The film is a lot of fun. I watch it every 7 or 8 years. It's kind of a classic of that kind of thing.
It's too violent for me to do that, I have to say.
I do wince at the violence, and this time around I was like, oh God, I can't watch the whole thing where Uma Thurman gets the thing in her chest.
I've seen it
enough times. I know what happens. I've seen it, so I just sat that a little bit out. Watching it for this particular theme, though, it's a film that is just, it's pure side characters. Just everybody is a side character in each other's story. Even characters like the wolf, who's like a Mr. Fix-It character who helps them out towards the end.
Yes.
His girlfriend, who just pops up for a couple of lines, and she's a bit sassy. And you just think, God, even with a few lines, she's been given a certain character and a certain energy. And that's what the whole film feels like. It's just these quite interesting side characters.
That's partly, I think, what makes it feel fresh, because it's very traditional to have one very three-dimensional, well-formed, generally male protagonist, and everyone around them just being sort of aiders and abettors and moving along their plot. And you don't even think about them outside of it. Whereas helped by this non-linear structure, these very much feel like their own people. They're all side characters, but also not, because they are all main characters in their own world.
Story.
And then, as you say, they're slotting into each other's stories.
Where in other people's stories, they're more background characters.
Which makes everything feel more unpredictable and therefore more exciting, I think.
Especially at the end, when it kind of dawns on you that they're in the same restaurant that's been held up earlier. So it's exciting to see how that's going to play out, because you know that a couple holding them up are a little bit unstable, but you also know the day that Jules has had. It's just interesting drama. That shows you how good the script writing is, that when that happens, it's not like a big battle at the end. They've not got to save the girl. There's no MacGuffin that are a countdown clock. But the feeling of dramatic tension of how is this going to resolve, it's perfectly pitched, you know, when it gets to that sequence at the end.
Yes, very true, very true. All right, shall we move on then to Fight Club?
Oh, yes, please. I'm guessing you must have seen Fight Club before, is it?
Oh, God, yeah. Actually, I've only seen it maybe twice, I guess. It's that classic thing. You watch it when you're a teenager and think, oh, my God, mind blown. Tyler Durden, it's so true, man. What he says is so true.
Yeah, right on, Lily.
Yeah,
against the system.
Classic. Exactly. Fucking hell. I remember it so clearly. I think I even began reading the novel, but the novel is actually very, very like the film. I remember thinking, this is so much like the film that I actually can't be bothered to read it because I just remember what happened. But it's based on a novel by Chuck Palahniuk, directed by David Fincher. What about you? When did you first watch it?
It took me a couple of years to watch it because it was the classic thing of somebody told me I would love this film, which means it automatically every part of my being has decided I hate it. So that's what happened. So
if I said that to you, would you think that?
I think instinctively my body would react like that, but my brain, I've got old enough, my coping mechanism would be, don't be like that, James. Of course, if you recommend the film, of course I would watch it. There's a contrariness inside me. It's the rebel on the outside of society, just like Tyler Durden. Exactly. Just didn't want to watch it because it was very popular. And then I watched it, like yourself, a couple of times. I never really particularly got into it, but this time round, I've appreciated it the most I've appreciated it. So I got into it more this time.
I think I've been on a journey with this movie because obviously, as I said, the first time it was like, whoa, mind blown, anti-capitalist, anti-consumerism.
Yeah, bam, man, bam, bam. In a Hollywood
and
film.
And then I think I watched it again a few years ago and went the other way with my feminism having evolved substantially and was very critical of it.
So where does it find you now, Lily?
Well, I mean, we should really get into the side characters of it all, but I was wondering what you make to the message of the film. Do you think that Chuck Palahniuk is being critical of Tyler Durden and, let's say, the director as we're talking about the film? Do you think the film's lens is critical of Tyler? Or
the feeling I get from it is that the filmmaker and the film is presenting it as very cool, and he's the ultimate hip cool guy, is Tyler Durden. So I think he's presented like that, but I don't think you are meant to fall head over heels thinking that he's a likable character. I think, isn't that the trick of the film, is that it's talking about how we're all wrapped up in society and culture and consumerism, and that we're impressed by shiny objects and we're looking for the next shiny object, and that Tyler Durden is presented deliberately as the ultimate, like, shiny, cool object.
I think that is it. Because I do think you are meant to fall in love with him, basically.
Yes.
Especially a guy watching this. You're meant to think he is the coolest, most charismatic, smart guy. It's not just the fact that it's Brad Pitt playing this guy in these, like, cool clothes and whatever, and his very cool, calm way of talking. It's the fact that a lot of what he says is true. We are all caught up in consumerism. There's a lot of fat that's mixed in with the bullshit. And so... Yeah. You get lured in. And I think that's the point.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
That's what feels weird about the film, right? Is that it can feel like the film is on his side, because right up until the end, I would say, it's trying to trick you, basically, in order to share this message of watch out, don't be lured in. I was thinking this is like contemporary Jordan Peterson. I feel like all the people in the film following his message...
Right.
They are like the people who are reading Jordan Peterson, because Jordan Peterson is very good at bringing some bits of truism and then referencing some smart Russian dude. And then everyone's like, oh, yeah, yeah. And it's like, yeah, but half of this is bullshit. And what's the ultimate message that you're putting across, that like women are shit and should be docile?
I hadn't thought of it like that, but you see what you're saying, that Fight Club is this kind of character that is appealing to men who feel that they've lost their way in life, isn't it? That's what Fight Club's about, is them reestablishing their masculinity, their dominance. I mean, again, this is not glamorous to me. I mean, you know, the thing I love about Fight Club is that the Fight Club itself is almost like a passing afterthought in the film. If you go to Fight Club looking for fighting, you'll probably be a bit disappointed.
It's almost just like the jumping off point for everything else, right?
Yeah.
But it's more than enough fighting for me. Like, I was like desperately wanting to skip through those bits. I kind of had to resist. I was like, no. In respect to the pod, I should endure it. But it's like horrible. But anyway, it's interesting to talk about in terms of our topic of main characters being like side characters, vice versa, because obviously the narrator, he isn't even named. He is so sort of passive as the lead. For himself, Tyler Durden is his protagonist in his own life.
We see him being created throughout the first act of the film. You see little flash frames of Tyler Durden pop up on screen. So he's breaking through his subconscious mind and being manifested by this unnamed narrator, who is a very empty, flat character who talks at length about how basically he's just following consumer trends and what he thinks his life should be like. So Tyler Durden is his aspirational character.
For sure. It's who he wants to be, right? I think in a way he is as interesting as the Tyler Durden character, and to me, more interesting because he says that he's completely bought into consumerism, he's got the job, but he's being so critical of that because he clearly is unhappy with it and is looking for ways out of the psychological state he's in. And so he's obviously got a lot of depth and he's a critical thinker for sure, but he has no sort of, he basically doesn't have any agency. I think that's why there's this dynamic between him and Tyler, the side character, being way more energetic and charismatic and a go-getter and like knows exactly what he thinks and is spouting all this philosophical stuff, because the main character's big problem is that he has all these feelings about everything, but he doesn't have a sense of agency. He wants to be given permission for everything he does.
Tyler Durden is very active. He's the catalyst that pushes the story along, isn't he? When he,
yes.
You know, Fight Club wouldn't exist without him. He's pushing the anarchy element of it. So he's,
yes.
he's making our passive protagonist more active, right? Yeah.
Yes, but then obviously, spoiler alert, the mad twist at the end is that Tyler Durden is the unnamed narrator. That's the creation of the unnamed narrator's mind, but it is actually the unnamed narrator who's doing all this stuff. So it's hilarious because we ultimately find out that our protagonist has been the bad, active character all along.
Yeah,
he's doing everything. But throughout the film, we're watching a side character take all of the credit and have all of the charisma.
And of course, and then when you see the actuality of what things were like when there is no Brad Pitt there, you miss Brad Pitt. It's not as cool when it's the unnamed narrator just throwing himself around.
I know. And even when it's him, when he talks to Marla and says all the stuff that Tyler's meant to have said. I mean, it's horrible. He treats her terribly, but he just doesn't have the same kind of panache about delivering.
It's a definitive Brad Pitt role. It plays on his natural charisma and chemistry. I can't imagine any other actor quite nailing it so well. And I loved Marla. I loved Helena Bonham Carter. It almost felt like that's the definitive role for her.
I think up until then, she'd only ever been cast in period films.
Like the classic English Rose.
She was seen as such a like woman out of time. Yeah. It was her first contemporary role.
And she's just great.
She is fantastic.
I have to say, even though I wasn't fully grabbed by the film the first few times I saw it, I always thought the thing that made it worth watching for me was her performance. Just where is she coming from? She just manages to, you're just not sure.
She's probably much more interesting than either of those two, if we're going to get into side characters who've got more about them, because she is a very interesting combination. She actually has everything that Edward Norton's character wants to. She does just do what she wants and is totally free the way she just,
and she
like,
doesn't worry about it.
Steals and goes to those meetings without actually being ill in a way that he doesn't. She is much more of a cruiser through life.
Yeah.
And has that sense of freedom. But the difference is, isn't hurting anyone and isn't trying to get everyone else to change. There's something I thought was interesting about Tyler Durden's whole attitude is that everything is wrong with the world around me. And so therefore the world around me needs to change. It's never about whether he should be doing anything different. Whereas Marla is a lot more like, there is a lot wrong with the world, so I'm just going to ignore the bits that don't work for me and treat it as I want to treat it. Nothing is my problem, but no one else, like, I'm not going to make my thing anyone else's problem either. Her disregard is a lot more healthy than his, even though, of course, she's choosing to opt out, not in an ideal way, but it's a lot more, it's interesting, it's a lot less.
Yeah, a lot less extreme.
A lot less destructive.
I think the line she says when she's confronted with, why do you come to these meetings? And she says, well, it's cheaper than a movie and there's free coffee.
Yeah, it is almost like she's an alien who's come down to Earth. And it's like, it's so weird the way you do these things. So I'm just going to sit back and see how it goes.
And smoke a cigarette looking cool. Cigarettes aren't cool, kids. Jesus Christ, it's like, it's the ultimate glamorizing smoking shots with her.
There is something, isn't there, about being a teenager, watching these things, not really getting what the underlying message truly is.
Because it's just cool, man.
I do think it is a deliberate choice to try and lure you in and seduce you in order to then show you how it all goes wrong. But it's very easy for people to miss the point of that, you know. That film was really lambasted for being so problematic. And I think actually. That's the opposite of what it's really trying to say.
I do think maybe it might get very lazily lumped as some kind of macho lads action film, which on the surface, it's got all those bits and bobs, but there's definitely much more going on. But it's one of those things like, is it ironic or is it being real? Does it matter that it's ironic? I don't know. I've got no idea.
No, exactly. Exactly. So basically, here's my thinking, is that I do think it's often more interesting when the main character themselves has a bit more of that side character passivity about them. And it's the people around them who are bringing a lot more interest to the story.
It definitely helps me self-insert if the central character isn't too colourful and too eccentric. But yeah, I don't know.
But the crucial thing for me with these movies is it's not that, like, I didn't want to do like a comedy sidekick or just that quirky friend, because for me, that's just to add a bit of humor. That's just to add a bit of color. What I think is more interesting is when they're actually very much embedded into the narrative, because Fight Club is crucially hinged on the relationship between Edward Norton as he's manipulated by Tyler Durden. And then obviously with that ultimate twist, it kind of sums it all up. But
the twist, which I realise is a riff to some degree on the ending of Grease. So we realise that Edward Norton has been Tyler Durden, the bad boy, all along. And we just didn't realise it. So,
and what are you saying? That Sandy has been Rizzo all along?
Well, no, I'm just saying that they've riffed on the idea that a character changes, whereas in Fight Club, it's not about a character changing. It turns out that it was the same character all along. But Edward Norton is presented as a very dowdy, very quiet, low-key character, which is what helps hide the fact that it's actually Tyler Durden. So by portraying him like that, by giving him the opposite characteristics, it means that it helps the twist. Much like when Sandy, after being in the whole film a bit of a wet blanket, is suddenly sexy Sandy, the transformation is more pronounced and more effective. The twist in Fight Club is more pronounced because we've bought the two different dynamics of the central characters.
Yeah, and also I think it's not a twist for the sake of it. That twist is really important because it shows why he goes down the path he goes down. It's because he's on this quest to be an individual with autonomy. And ultimately that's where it leads to, is that he realizes that actually he had to create this character in order to do what he wanted to do. And then he has to also kill that character because he realizes he's made it too strong.
We've all been there, made it too strong.
All right. Shall we wrap up with a quick question? James. Which side characters would you like to see given their own movie?
The first thing that came to mind, and as soon as I thought it, I thought, oh no, they've had their own movie spin-off, and I didn't go and see it, which would be Han Solo. That's like a cautionary tale of be careful what you wish for. There's a reason side characters are side characters in a film, because they don't work when they are suddenly the lead character. I think it might be a bit too chaotic if we had side characters as leads. We might find it A, harder to relate to them, B, that their extreme personality types might be, when they are just the lead of a film, a bit too much for an audience. You might start to resent the characters because the film is now pivoting around them rather than them orbiting around the lead character.
Okay, you might be right. What I would like, though, is for a main character who is an active protagonist to be put in as a side character in another film. I realize this happens quite a bit of like superhero movies, right?
Yeah.
But in like a non-superhero movie context.
Ooh, have you got one to mind?
Well, it's not very exciting actually, because it's just because we were talking about him at the start, but I would love to see James Bond be a side character to like another woman in the office. But maybe a different role in the civil service rather than a spy.
So James Bond does some hot desking, and we could have it as a rom-com, and she's a bit awkward and socially nervous. So James Bond, being the suave ladies man, helps get her up to speed and
schools
all that kind of stuff.
Schools her, yeah, and gives her a makeover and everything. Yeah, because it turns out James Bond is actually gay.
there we go. Yeah, no. I'm glad to have brainstormed this film with you here, Lily.
I'll start working on a treatment. All right. Shall we finish up the episode with another entry to the film Pharmacy?
Yes, please.
All right. So we had this email. Uh-huh. Says, "Dear Groovy Movies, I'm going to be spending a weekend with my girlfriend's family soon. They've suggested we watch a movie together on the second night. She has a large extended family, so there'll be probably kids there as well as adults, and half the family don't speak English. Any ideas what we could watch? I love this. This is a proper movie question, not too heavy.
Yeah, I know, right? We haven't got any emotional issues to sort out or in relationships. Whew, this is like actually straightforward. So I'm thinking something family friendly, but also something that doesn't pivot around any one language. So I'm thinking a silent movie could be quite good. And I'm thinking, especially kids and silent movies in black and white, they're probably going to have a short attention span for it. So let's go for one of the shorter features that was popular around that time. I'm going to recommend for a family viewing situation going for Buster Keaton's Sherlock Jr. So it's physical comedy. You're going to see Buster Keaton at the height of his powers being a complete madman for your entertainment. And, you know, it's got no language, so you can just enjoy the visual humor, the slapstick. And, you know, it's a fun thrill ride and it's a good laugh.
Oh, that's a really good one. You've smashed that. God damn it. Okay. My idea was a Studio Ghibli film.
Nice.
Because they're definitely kid-friendly, but amazing. I'm obsessed with all those movies. Like, so the parents will enjoy too. And I'm pretty sure, because they're Japanese, I'm pretty sure you could get the subtitles for, like, I don't know which language the family speak, but you can probably find the right subtitles for them, so you could do an overdub plus subtitle situation. I'd probably recommend My Neighbor Totoro. Totoro?
I've not seen that one. I've only seen Howl. Have I seen Howl's Moving Castle?
Sure. I love that one too. I love My Neighbor Totoro, okay. But I don't know if I'm saying it correctly. Totoro.
Totoro. Something?
Let's say My Neighbor Totoro. The other thing I thought was Coco. I watched that recently, the Pixar movie.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely loved that.
Okay.
Very family friendly, but great for parents too, adults.
Okay.
But I think yours is probably the one. That's a great shout.
Well, you know, just trying to just twist it up a little bit. I'm very relieved that it's a bit of a straight up, here's a question about a film. Thank you so much.
Though, I mean, I love the deep ones too. I love being an agony aunt.
This is more like a busman's holiday. It's like, oh, you know, you don't have to think too much.
Ah. All right. Well, that wraps up another episode of Groovy Movies. Our episode next week will be our last in the series. So make
Can
sure
you listen.
Can you
believe end of season two?
It's gone so quickly. If you've enjoyed the series and like what we do, please do leave us a review and give us 5 stars on Apple. It really helps people find us.
We really appreciate anything you can do like that. The more people can discover us, the better. So yeah, we really appreciate that. Thank you for listening.
And we will see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Follow us on Instagram at groovymoviespod or email us groovymoviespod@gmail.com.
Groovy Movies was produced and edited by Lily Austin.
Music and sound by James Brailsford.
Our logo was designed by Abby Jo Sheldon.
For references and more information about the films discussed, check out the show notes.